has done any work on UNESCO's approach to these questions, and also has experience internationally and specifically in the policy context of the ethics of these technologies. So we have a very interesting panel of participants. I explained to our participants earlier that when I chair a panel, the only way, the easy way, is to get people to keep the time. That's the easy way to run the event. So we do try to keep things moving. And delighted to welcome as our first speaker.
I'll give you a 2 minute warning.
Thank you. I've missed out the long introduction. The age of personalised medicine usually heralded as bringing a move away from the traditional pattern of diagnosis and treatment of disease in a sick patient, and a move towards a new pattern of prediction and prevention, maintaining health in an apparently symptom-free patient by intervening early to initiate treatment before too much damage has been done, or, of course, by lifestyle advice that can delay or prevent a condition developing altogether. And it's also thought that clinical practice will change as well, as it becomes possible to match drug regimes and treatment to a person's genotype. Now, those sound like very positive gains. So why is it that they appear to raise so many questions about human rights, confidentiality, informed consent and protection from discrimination? About 5 years ago, some German researchers, who were obviously preoccupied by those sort of questions, published an article with the title, "Why Should We Bother? Ethical and Social Issues in Individualized Medicine." Now, the authors explained their reasons for asking this rather provocative question in this way, and I'm quoting, "Prescribing the right drug in the right dose to the right patient according to specific health needs and individual characteristics is a core mission of individualized medicine. The intrinsic values of this mission are so self-evident that, at first glance, the ethical and social issues raised by individualized medicine seem to be negligible." Well, that seems to be a good summary of the position, and it does appear that at around the same time, the new possibilities had also attracted the attention of the UK government, perhaps encouraged by some rather over-hasty speculation about the possible advantages of introducing a universal programme of profiling babies at birth. For in 2003, the government turned to the Human Genetics Commission, which is a body charged with the broad task of advising the government on new developments in genetic science, and also to an older advisory body, the National Screening Committee, for advice on that subject. Well, the HGC had engaged quite energetically with questions relevant to the issue. One of its earliest reports discussed the sale of genetic testing kits direct to the public. And more recently, it's reflected on the potential impact on individual lives of the more sophisticated advances in personalized medicine of the kind we're discussing here today. It has a strong commitment to involving the public, and it has a consultative panel of around 100 people, all of whom have direct experience of a genetic condition, and asks them to comment on its draft reports and its options and priorities for future work. And I'll just give you a very short list of its relevant reports for. There's with Inside Information, a report on the protection of genetic information in 2002. Genes Direct, a review of direct genetic testing services in 2003. More Genes Direct, on the availability and marketing regulation of genetic tests applied direct to the public, 2007. And then the last one, as I mentioned, was on profiling the newborn. A report on genetic profiling at birth came out in 2005 in response to that request from the government. Now, it was because of my own experiences working on that last report that I was encouraged to set out some of the issues in the form of an article in Nature Genetics. And in my article, I set out the arguments, ethical and social arguments, raised by any proposal to engage with a population-wide program of genetic profiling at birth. I didn't say very much about the feasibility of the proposal. As you noticed, I'm not a scientist, it's outside my remit. Although, of course, like everyone else I know, 5 years later, it was not a pipe dream. We can also see that for the most part, many of the arguments, both those for and against, don't just apply to the newborn, but to people as all ages. Nor is it just a matter of individual or personal interest. They can have implications for families and also for wider social or ethnic groups who may be found to be particularly prone to a particular genetic condition. All the same, many people do see the possibilities in a positive light, although I thought I'd mention some journalists who boldly took the plunge into genome analysis at the bidding of a TV channel, and I think found that the ability to foresee your own future can be an immense blessing. But let me try to set out what I see as the main considerations, the main ethical and legal issues. I'll take first the question of harm or benefit. A key question is whether routinizing profiling as a medical tool would do more harm than good, not only for the individual concerned, but also at the level of public benefit. Because it's a sound and long accepted ethical principle that medicine should seek the good of its clients and avoid harming them. The risk involved in fact-finding about one's health on this kind of scale, though popular with some people, is that it risks turning basically healthy people into perpetual patients. Now, you might see that as a personal matter, but it does also point to a problem at the public level, a potential burden for the health service in the form of an influx of the worried well. So that's about harm and benefits, and the rest of what I want to say is to put these is divided into two parts. The first, some points that apply at the individual and personal level, and then the second that apply at the public policy level. So, right, I turn straight away to consent and the burden of self-knowledge, the right and the right not to know. I start by saying that, of course, profiling can bring the discovery of serious genetic disorders and conditions, and that's where the question about consent comes in first. Would people be willing to consent to investigations with such far-reaching consequences if they were more fully informed? If as far as an individual is concerned, a person is currently symptom-free, and the condition isn't susceptible to early treatment, finding out about it prematurely could have damaging effects for personal life. An apparently healthy person might come to see themselves or be seen by others as already, in some sense, impaired. And of course, knowledge can be particularly burdensome in the case of late onset disorders, such as Huntington's chorea. Now, while some people may be robust enough to live with their diagnosis, for others it might cast a shadow over long-term life plans, including important decisions about marriage and children. So it's for reasons like that, there's a right not to know has been taken seriously in other areas of medicine in relation to diseases which are not genetic in origin. It's particularly important in the case of what might be called impotent knowledge. That is, knowledge that one might develop a disease for which no treatment is available. So it must also be taken into account in relation to a situation in which someone may not have understood the full implications of their consent, only to discover that knowledge is irreversible a burden that cannot be lifted. Now, that places the issue of consent in a special light as far as other family members are concerned. For it's a basic principle in medicine that consent should be fully informed and based on adequate counselling. But when one family member has sought information about a genetic condition, what they've found out, whether by profiling or direct testing, might affect other family members who've not consented to testing themselves and may not even know their relative was seeking advice, nor what the implications might be for themselves. You can't give consent by proxy, or consent can't be given by proxy, and yet for these people, the other family members, the discovery of a family hazard to which they're also susceptible may significantly affect their lives, their interests, and their well-being, disrupting stable situations with foreknowledge that has no practical value. So I think it's especially important to ask, in that case, is there a right not to know? Now, I realise all that's begun to sound rather negative, so I thought I would make at least an important point on the other side. Medicine has become much more open than it used to be, and many people would and do insist on their right to knowledge. And in this case, knowing about familial risks could open choices to people who want to have children to choose some of the possibilities offered by the reproductive technologies so as to be able to have children without passing on their genetic risks. Right, well, those are all complex matters, and a reminder that consent in this context is usually linked to the term informed. But there's a question, this is the next point, that there's a question as to how far people can be genuinely informed in a field as complex as DNA profiling, which demands some understanding of genetic science, principles of epidemiology, including a grasp of risks and of statistics, and a realistic appreciation of possible future developments in medical treatments for a diagnosed condition. All of those must be involved in discussion with a medical advisor, both before and after, especially when it turns out there are adverse findings. And, of course, even for professionals, the interpretation of results is problematic. So, all right, those are the questions I wanted to put in the box of the personal, the thoughts of a person who might be involved in all of this. But when these problems come out into the public world of jobs, housing, mortgages and insurance, then more of the focus comes, it turns on privacy, confidentiality and the possibility of discrimination. So they all stem really from the increased range of personal information that a DNA profile can supply. For once that information has been generated, it's always possible that it will be released into the wider domain. So to begin with, there are questions as to where and with whom data should be stored. Many would be concerned at the thought that extensive and intimate information about them had been placed in an accessible form in their health centre or doctor's surgery, particularly knowing that office and nursing staff, receptionists, other doctors, and possibly various state agencies might be able to access it. They're already concerned about the retention of DNA records by the police, but it seems that most people, preoccupied with the issue of guilt or innocence, which they see as relevant to forensic DNA databases, have not seen the potential link between these two. Getting the records good in health, bad in crime area. Right, but however information enters the public domain, it's difficult to ensure that it will not be wrongly accessed or misused. And that brings with it the possibility of unfair discrimination. Well, there was a much quoted illustration of this in the US in the 1970s, when sickle cell screening in the US Air Force led to discrimination against people who were unaffected carriers only of the disease. So it's not there've been many and are many more cases in the USA currently, which I've got some notes about. It's not surprising then that there's a frequently expressed fear that the wider availability of genetic information might lead to the development of a genetic underclass deprived of access to jobs, mortgages and insurance by onerous rules of disclosure and commercial policies of avoiding bad risks. And while it would seem out of the question that insurance companies would ever be able to demand that a potential client should accept genetic profiling, there are more realistic fears that insurance companies and employers might one day decide to ask for more limited genetic data. And this adds to fears that awareness of genetic conditions could lead to the stigmatising of people with a diagnosed genetic condition. Now, as far as insurance is concerned, there's a risk that this knowledge is so powerful that it may, in the not-too-distant future, undermine the whole principle on which insurance is based. On the one hand, it could, as I said, create a whole class of uninsurable people who'd be deprived of access to basics like the ability to obtain a mortgage, itself normally dependent on getting life insurance. On the other hand, if we attempt to avoid this by maintaining the principle of the confidentiality of genetic information, this will present opportunities for fraud, at least as far, or at least unfairness to other insurance seekers. So after all, what is insurance? It's essentially a provision made from behind a veil of ignorance by the majority for a minority to which they may or may not belong at a future date. Their own current state of ignorance is a key condition. But new genetic technologies have the potential to break that natural barrier of ignorance of present and future, placing on the individual the onus of carrying the burden of greatly increased knowledge of their own circumstances. But medicine is an area in which it's traditionally been assumed that individuals have ownership of their own private information, even if they do share it by consent with their own doctors. So I'll just say this right to confidentiality then is like consent, another long-held principle of medical ethics. Currently, though, as you all know, there's a voluntary moratorium with insurance companies in the UK, which means insurers don't ask for genetic information and applicants are under no obligation to supply it. It's hard to know how long that will last. What is clear is that a wider exploration of genetic characteristics by individuals could add to the number of people who might be at risk of genetic discrimination. And this could include healthy people who only have a risk of developing a condition, and also perhaps, as in that US case, to healthy carriers. Now, given that those problems in relation to what just what those are problems just in relation to one discrimination issue, that of insurance, though with its links to both housing and employment, choices may have to be made by governments, and it's worth just speculating as to what these might be. One option would be to take the Netherlands route, which is to rule against companies taking genetic information into account, but to set the possible payout very low. Another would be for the state to offer a tailor-made system to provide the safeguards that an insurance policy would supply, including mortgage arrangements for people who know their genetic situation seriously disadvantages them. Well, whatever's decided, it can, I think, be assumed that there would still be a role for state agencies, together with charities and support groups, in helping people with a life-affecting genetic condition. So I've only touched on all these points, but I expect we're going to be discussing them much more closely later on. I'll just finish off by saying that my last heading is knowing our genetic selves. The question I've tried to address is how we should respond to the self-knowledge that genetic science can offer. I began by pointing out that as far as healthcare is concerned, it's a sound and qualified ethical principle that medical professionals should seek to benefit their patients and avoid harming them. Certainly a consideration, then, that the number of diseases that can successfully be treated once identified is quite limited, So patients may well be harmed if, as a result of prematurely identifying their condition, they're cut off from such social goods as insurance, mortgage provision, and employment. Now, this isn't to deny that the new genetics offers attractive possibilities. The opportunity for disease prevention or control by early intervention, more effective medicines and tailor-made dosing regimes, and it could also save patients from unnecessarily embarking on unpleasant procedures such as preventive surgery, and spare them the effects of adverse reactions to drugs by making their personal risk much more specific. And there are also financial considerations here, both for healthcare providers, individuals, and the pharmaceutical industry. The challenge then is to achieve some of the good things while avoiding a situation in which knowledge combined with a duty to disclose can bring discrimination, and with it a disincentive to individuals to take advantage of medical advances from which they might in the end benefit.
Three more minutes if you'd like.
There's a question.
Yeah, we'll save them for the panel.
Yes.